And therefore, as we can see, rather than the industry waiting for supranational bodies such as IMO and the EU to take the lead and dictate the necessary changes that are needed to decarbonize the industry, we are now also seeing stakeholders such as financiers and charterers setting the pace and introducing decarbonization measures themselves. So welcome one and all to our 13th episode of the Law Boot podcast, and this one being the fourth episode focusing particularly on the shipping industry. My name is Matthew Kassar. I'm an associate at Fennec & Fennec Advocates, and I work within the Ship Finance and Ship Registration Department. Our discussion today aims to answer some of the most burning questions with respect to the shipping industry and climate change. It is a very topical subject, and we aim to delve into what measures have been introduced by supranational entities such as the IMO and EU with a view to address the environmental impact of shipping. We're also going to look into those measures that have been introduced voluntarily by different stakeholders. Further on, we're going to discuss the role of technology within the sphere of the shipping industry and, of course, climate change. And we want to delve into and we'll be discussing whether financiers will be acting as critical players within this drive to decarbonize and to bring the shipping world at a new stage where it is environmentally, its environmental impact is reduced. Well, to open up this discussion, I want to delve into an expression which I came across recently, and it goes as follows. If the highest aim of a captain were to preserve his ship, he would keep it in port forever. And really, in preparing for this podcast, I found myself reflecting on this quote, particularly as a metaphor for the shipping industry as a whole. Shipping as an industry has multifaceted targets, and it really cannot rest on its laurels or proverbially be kept in port for it to grow to meet these targets, particularly these environmental targets. The industry must always evolve and not just preserve its status. Well, with me today to discuss this area of law and policy is Peter Grima, who's a senior associate at Fennec & Fennec Advocates, a colleague of mine, and works within the Ship Finance Department. Welcome, Peter. It's a pleasure to share this podcast with you again.
Hi, Matt. Thanks for the introduction. Before delving into all the nitty-gritty, I would like to start off by stating that there's no two ways about it. Sustainability concerns are firmly at the forefront of the shipping industry's agenda, and as well as the world's agenda for that matter. And in order to ground our discussions with respect to this extremely vast area of law and policy, I would like to share a few facts and figures about the shipping industry. So, for instance, while shipping is comparatively by far the most efficient and least polluting means of conducting international trade, the global merchant shipping fleet is quite significant in size. It numbers approximately 65,000 merchant vessels, and the vast majority of these merchant vessels are running on diesel fuel. Naturally, all this movement comes with a carbon footprint, which is estimated at approximately 1.5 billion tons of CO2 emissions per annum. And while that number might not mean much to us lawyers, it is equivalent to approximately 3% of CO2 emissions globally. This may not seem significant, particularly when considering that approximately 90% of global trade is carried out by sea. But I found it of interest to note that if shipping were a country, it would actually be the sixth largest emitter in the world after Germany. So, collectively, these facts help us to contextualize the impact that shipping has on global CO2 emissions, and highlights the reasons why we are seeing this impetus in global efforts to decarbonize shipping.
Those are interesting figures. I always find that, you know, these facts assist industry players and also our listeners to better understand the task at hand with respect to this drive to lower carbon, the carbon footprint of the shipping industry. From a historical point of view, it can be said that the shipping industry has flown somewhat under the radar for many years when it comes to environmental measures. And there are really practical reasons for this. Firstly, it must be said that the shipping industry was bereft of necessary technology to satisfy measures aimed at reducing environmental impact. As we will see, technology plays an integral role and an integral part with respect to environmental measures. Secondly, and on a more positive note, the industry boasts a much smaller impact on the global carbon footprint, and this particularly when compared to other sectors. Times have now changed, however, and the shipping industry has to really wake up and smell the coffee, as a number of significant environmental measures have been introduced and are to be introduced and implemented. Most pertinently, the International Maritime Organization, IMO, has agreed to reduce GHG, greenhouse gas emissions, from shipping by 50%. This is when compared to the 2008 baseline levels. The target must be met by 2050. This is no short feat, and really it is one of the cornerstones to facilitate achieving the decarbonization targets as set out in the Paris Agreement of 2015. Within the Paris Agreement of 2015, the EU aims to reach carbon neutrality by 2050, as compared to 1990 baseline levels. A few interesting facts. It is very interesting to note that 40% of the world fleet by gross tonnage is EU controlled, and 70% of global trade is conducted within EU waters. Essentially, therefore, the EU is at the very forefront of pushing decarbonization of the maritime industry.
Yes, the EU has traditionally been a swifter forum to introduce climate change mitigation measures when compared to the IMO, which has typically been a bit slower in view of its broader approach and its broader application. This being said, EU measures and IMO measures tend to complement one another, as ultimately both are aimed at achieving the same target, which is essentially that of reducing carbon emissions, and this with a view to achieving carbon neutrality. A perfect example of this is the introduction of the EU monitoring, reporting and verification regulations as compared to the IMO data collection scheme. Both of these measures complement one another and are ultimately geared towards imposing reporting obligations on the carbon intensity of shipping activities. Other significant developments in decarbonization have certainly been the IMO's introduction of amendments to the MARPOL Convention, which established a global cap on the sulfur content in marine fuels, as well as a Mediterranean emissions control area for sulfur oxides and particulate matter. This measure was introduced in 2020, I believe, and pursuant to which the permissible sulfur content in marine fuels consumed by all ocean-going vessels was required to drop from a previous 3.5% mass-by-mass content to just 0.5% mass-by-mass content. And then, for emissions control areas, the regulations were even more stringent, with a maximum permitted sulfur content of 0.1% mass-by-mass content. Since then, the IMO has gone on to further introduce other sustainability and environmental measures, including the likes of the Energy Efficiency Design Index, more commonly referred to as the EEDI, the Annual Operational Carbon Intensity Indicator, which is commonly referred to as the CII rating, and an Enhanced Ship Energy Efficiency Management Plan. And we can go into this in a bit further detail later on. But what has also been encouraging to note is that the shipping industry has in recent years gone one step further in transforming its approach to further sustainability, with stakeholders actually voluntarily introducing various measures such as the Poseidon Principles, which have been driven by leading ship finance banks, as well as the Sea Cargo Charter, which has been driven by leading charterers. And therefore, as we can see, rather than the industry waiting for supranational bodies such as IMO and the EU to take the lead and dictate the necessary changes that are needed to decarbonize the industry, we are now also seeing stakeholders such as financiers and charterers setting the pace and introducing decarbonization measures themselves.
Well, you touched upon some very interesting points here, Pete, and particularly with respect to the interplay between measures introduced at a supranational level and those introduced by market players. I will be shining a spotlight on those measures introduced at a supranational level, both EU and IMO. The regulations introduced by these entities bring into play the monitoring and reporting of GHG emissions. By allowing such emissions data to be available and accessible to the public, we believe this will contribute to the removing of, you know, market barriers that prevent the uptake of many cost-negative measures which could eventually reduce GHG emissions from maritime transport. From an EU perspective, the monitoring, reporting and verification regulations has been in place since 2018. These regulations apply to vessels over 5,000 gross tons, and it essentially requires ship owners to submit annual emissions report to the EU Commission. Particularly, it extends to emissions from fuels consumed on voyages within the EU, but also as well to those voyages to and from the EU. On the other hand, IMO have introduced the CII regulation. This came into effect on 1st January 2023 and essentially is based on the annual fuel consumption of each and every ship. Ships subject to the CII rating are required to do a number of criteria and matters. Particularly, ship owners must develop an SEEMP, which is essentially the Ship Energy Efficiency Management Plan. And this is to be included within the CII calculation methodology with a plan for achieving the required CII values over the next 3 years. Ship owners must also develop procedures for the self-evaluation and improvement, which are need to be in line with the requirements of the vessel's recognized organization. From 2023, IMO's data collection system, the DCS, will be subject to the CII rating. Ratings range from A, B, C, D, or E, and these will be given to each and every ship from 2024. It is interesting to note that for ships that have a rating that is E in a particular year or D rating for 3 consecutive years, the ship owners must develop a corrective action plan, and the action plan must need to be confirmed by the recognized organization. However, reporting requirements, whilst being essential, are only just one part of the equation. IMO has a multifaceted approach to this problem, and there are short-term and long-term targets. One other measure introduced by IMO is the progressive tightening of technical efficiency standards for new build ships. And these standards really emanate from the Mandatory Energy Efficiency Design Index, or the EEDI. This requires that, you know, several categories of ships delivered in 2023 need to be at least 30% more carbon efficient than ships delivered before 2013. Also, large new container ships must be at least 50% more efficient. It has also become mandatory as of 1st January 2023 for all ships to calculate their attained EEDI. This is in order for them to measure the energy efficiency and also to initiate the collection of data for the reporting of their annual operation carbon intensity indicator, or CII rating. Of course, ship owners must bear in mind that there are different types of monitoring methods available to them. Ship owners must choose the monitoring method which is particular to their vessel, and they must document that method chosen. The plans and emissions report are of course to be verified by accredited verifiers on an annual basis.
Agreed, Matt. As you have mentioned, ship owners have a lot more to contend with these days, and the measures you have just mentioned are merely the reporting requirements introduced by IMO to tighten the rope, so to speak, in terms of decarbonization. Complementing the IMO's requirements are also the voluntary measures we mentioned earlier, namely the Sea Cargo Charter introduced by charterers, as well as the Poseidon Principles introduced by the main ship finance banks. The Sea Cargo Charter itself was actually inspired by the launch of the Poseidon Principles in 2019 and has been developed in recognition of the role that charterers play in promoting responsible environmental stewardship throughout the maritime value chain. The Sea Cargo Charter's main ambition is to address climate alignment, accountability, and also transparency in data collection on emissions following each voyage, and it applies to all signatories in bulk chartering activities. These may include time of voyage charters as well as voyages carried out by vessels engaged in international trade. Now, as of 2022, the Sea Cargo Charter has actually applied to all vessels irrespective of tonnage, whereby charter signatories are required on an annual basis to calculate the greenhouse gas emission intensity and total greenhouse gas emissions of chartering activities, and are to assess their climate alignment. So therefore, the Sea Cargo Charter actually goes beyond the obligations imposed by IMO, which, as you mentioned, Matt, limited reporting requirements to vessels above 5,000 gross tons. The Poseidon Principles, on the other hand, could be said to be the most prominent manifestation of sustainability considerations in finance, and today its principles have been adopted by most of the world's leading ship finance banks. The Poseidon Principles themselves provide a framework for these banks to monitor and disclose the carbon intensity of their shipping portfolios, and this with a view to keep in line with IMO targets. Today, I would say approximately 7% of the global financial portfolio banks have signed up to the Poseidon Principles, which have been incredibly successful and a palpable example of the significant ability of stakeholders, in this case financiers, to drive the sustainability agenda forward by directing financing towards cleaner fuels and more clean, cleaner technologies.
Agreed. On the face of it, one might find that sustainability and ESG as a whole being driven by financiers as surprising. However, at the outset, financiers are running a really tight ship with respect to environmental measures, as financiers themselves are facing scrutiny on their ESG credentials. And this scrutiny is coming from their own stakeholders, regulators, and even NGOs. Well, this uptake in increased responsibility towards environmental considerations is a sign of the times, and it will be directly linked to access to finance. Really, this might not be an issue right now, as ship owners are by and large in a strong financial position, but it will be definitely something that ship owners and charterers need to consider going forward, as the impact and the importance of increased sustainability is here to stay. And the requirements of law and policy and regulation are only expected to increase. Naturally, these emissions reduction and reporting measures that we have mentioned earlier have either been introduced voluntarily by stakeholders or by the IMO, with similarly complementary measures introduced at EU level. At this juncture, I'd like to delve into certain measures introduced at EU level which have not yet been a feature within IMO regulations. Namely, we find the EU Emissions Trading Scheme and the Fuel EU Maritime. The Fuel EU Maritime is part of the Fit for 55 package, which is a package established by the EU to reduce its net greenhouse gas emissions by at least 55% by 2030. This is as compared to 1990 levels. And also, the aim is to achieve climate neutrality by 2050. This has been recently introduced and it supports efforts to decarbonize international shipping. The EU has introduced regulations on the carbon content of maritime fuel, with implications for both EU and non-EU ship operators. Essentially, it proposes a common EU regulatory framework to increase the share of both renewable and low-carbon fuels in the fuel mix of international maritime transport. And this will be seen to be gradually increasing. So the trajectory goes from 2% reduction in GHG emissions by 2025 and arriving to up to as much as 80% reduction by 2050. The deal complements the provisional agreement reached in December 2022 to include shipping emissions in the EU Emissions Trading Scheme. The EU Emissions Trading Scheme was first introduced in 2005. The EU ETS is due to commence in 2024, and essentially it will require that each EU jurisdiction will ensure that a pass-through of ETS costs from ship owner to the operator. And it is based on the idea that the polluter will have to pay for the emissions through the surrender of annual emissions allowances. At the current rate per tonnage of CO2, we would estimate that the average carbon cost per day would amount to several thousands of dollars. However, it remains to be seen whether these costs will be enough to change behaviors or whether additional costs will be absorbed. It is also a question mark as to whether the rest of the world will follow suit.
Yes, as you intimate, Matt, the EU ETS and Fuel EU Maritime are another potentially big game changer and another part of this puzzle that makes up the EU's approach and overall policy to achieving its decarbonization targets. Here it's important to note that although the EU's environmental targets for shipping are well understood by the industry, there is not yet consensus on how to meet these targets. For instance, imposing the polluter pays principle is one such measure which you have just mentioned, and this to expedite technological advancements in shipping, as the technological challenge to date has been quite immense and can be said to be one of the main stultifiers in the shipping decarbonization process. In addition to these technical issues, costs are also a concern. Unsurprisingly, costs are a main driver to a ship owner's decisions to invest in new technology. And this can hold back the adoption of more expensive refits to render a vessel more efficient and greener. However, it must be said that while costs are naturally a consideration, ship owners are by and large not averse to invest in new technologies, especially if they see that it will save them on costs in the long term. Therefore, one of the main issues at the moment is the absence of consensus on the technology that should be invested in, as well as the fear that those who fail to invest in new clean tech could gain unfair advantage in the event of lack of enforcement of sustainability obligations. This is one of the main challenges of our industry, namely to instill confidence that the green transition is necessary and also economically advantageous in the long run. So, for instance, LNG and LPG, as well as biofuels, were no more than a mere 2 years ago deemed to be the most attractive alternative fuel sources, and today they are deemed to be a lot less attractive. Now, the reasons for this differ. For LNG and LPG, they are largely twofold. Firstly, while gas as a fuel source emits half the CO2 as regular marine fuel, it also emits methane, which we understand is a more harmful greenhouse gas emission. So, while using LNG or LPG as a fuel source may lead to a reduction in carbon emissions, and therefore reduction, we will be able to attain our targets for carbon emissions more easily, it could simultaneously lead to an increase in greenhouse gas emissions, which would be self-defeating to our climate change goals. Secondly, the price of LPG and LNG has been extremely volatile and has increased tremendously, particularly over the last year or so, which has made it a lot less feasible than we ever perceived it to be. As you would expect, this scenario can be extremely problematic, as there are many vessels that are running, already running on LNG or LPG, or are being built to run on this fuel source. And yet it is already deemed more costly and more polluting than other fuels, alternative fuels available today. With respect to biofuels, there is similarly the increasing concern that this alternative fuel source could essentially involve double counting, as it is not only emitting CO2, but in some cases it also results in the destruction of carbon sinks that would otherwise have been an important source of CO2 absorption. Therefore, it gives rise to a situation that unless we are able to capture the CO2 before it is emitted, it could actually be counterintuitive to use biofuels. And this then leads us full circle, and we have to ask the question, if we are capable of capturing the CO2 before it is released into the atmosphere and can use the CO2 elsewhere, then why should we not stick to the regular cheaper fuel we have today? So, as you can see, Matt, there is a lot of discussion on what to invest in and when to invest in it, and the answer is not that straightforward.
The reality is that there is a plethora of fuels for consideration. Ship owners are spoilt for choice, as aside from LNG, LPG and biofuel, there is also wind, hydrogen, ammonia, methanol and to a lesser extent, nuclear. For short voyages, there is also talk of electric, which for the time being is not deemed a viable option for longer voyages. All of these options are not optimum at the moment, in that they invariably entail some form of emissions. But really, this should not be a driving force to maintain the status quo. But rather, the general viewpoint is that these options are all interim alternative fuels, until the fuel for the future, or fuel of the future, so to speak, is found. Ship owners will need to be on the ball with transitioning to optimum greener fuels. This is in order to reduce their overall carbon footprint and, essentially, to avoid being left high and dry, both in terms of falling behind competition as well as losing out on fuel supply contracts with competing industries. For instance, the fertilizer industry is a major purchaser of ammonia for fertilizer production. In terms of wind as a potential source of power, this can also help lower the fuel consumed by up to 20%. While on its own this is not viewed as a solution, it can be a facilitator to greater efficiency. On the other hand, methanol, ammonia and hydrogen are now increasingly touted as the more optimal alternative fuels. Ammonia and green methanol are viewed as more attractive within today's technology, whilst hydrogen could be the fuel of the future if cost and safety considerations are addressed. All of this takes us back to the importance of R&D, research and development, and of ensuring that sufficient efforts are made to address technological shortfalls. It is often said that if one does not know to which port one is sailing, no wind is indeed favorable. Therefore, a lack of direction on where the shipping industry should invest could result in a loss of confidence to take necessary bold steps in the sustainability transition. It is a big ask for ship owners to be the first movers for new technology and propulsion without some form of risk sharing. Exactly how this will work is really subject to debate, but common ideas include R&D funds from governments and banks, credits from shipyards for greener options, such as dual fuel ships, and longer charter terms or higher rates to support clear investments for ship owners. On this point, it is pertinent to mention that Malta was among a coalition of states that proposed the establishment of an EU maritime fund and an international research and development board in order to accelerate R&D of zero carbon technologies and their deployment.
R&D is essential and there's no denying that. But ship owners and ship operators can't sit back and wait for this fuel of the future that you've mentioned earlier, Matt, to emerge before they start taking the necessary steps to optimize their carbon footprint. As truth be told, regulations and obligations are increasing at a faster rate today than the technology is. There is growing consensus on the need to introduce a carbon tax or levy led by the IMO and operating on the polluter pays principles, which would be similar to the EU ETS. And so those ship operators who are not yet prepared to invest in greener fuels need to start considering the implementation of all operational and technical measures available today to achieve energy efficiency, if they are not yet prepared to invest in this greener fuel. This may include speed optimization. It could include innovation in hydrodynamics optimization of navigable routes, the introduction of more efficient propulsion methods. You mentioned, for instance, earlier, wind assist technologies. That's one such option. But generally, there's also optimization of the maritime logistics chain. So to repeat what we have already said, companies should be looking to formulate sustainability policies, as whether we like it or not, reporting obligations are also only going to continue to gain traction, particularly as stakeholders and end users look towards the sustainability of supply chains. This, in my view and in the view of many other practitioners, will be a next driver for further sustainability, as businesses now globally look to not only clean up their company, but also look to clean up their supply chains, and this in tandem with their own individual carbon footprint. Lastly, to emphasize what was said earlier, availability of finance is certainly looking like it is going to become more and more tight to sustainability practices. And as we have seen with the success of the Poseidon Principles and other measures, the impetus is certainly with greater accountability on emissions targets. My personal view is that if ship owners hold back from taking bold decisions in cleaner technology today, they will most likely find access to capital more difficult when they need it going forward.
Well, I think that's a fair summary of all that we have discussed today on the sustainable developments and consideration within the maritime industry, and really one to which I have nothing further to add. So on that note, being conscious of time as well, I believe we can conclude this episode of Law Boot. Thank you all for tuning into this discussion between Peter and myself. We'd also like to thank Diane Kutayer, a trainee within our Ship Registration and Ship Finance Department, for her assistance in preparing the content for this podcast. Please look out for our next episode. Thank you all.